You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Welcome to HealthCetera, brought to you by the Center for Health, Media, and Policy at Hunter College, City University of New York. I'm Eve Adler, one of the producers of HealthCetera, reporting to you from Los Angeles, California. On today's HealthCetera, I am here with Ferris Kawar. Ferris is the co-founder and vice president of sustainability at Greenopia, which we'll hear more about. He sits on the board of advisors for Sustainable Works, is a member of Green Business Networking Steering Committee, and previously sat on the Burbank Green Alliance Steering Committee. Ferris is currently the sustainability project manager at Santa Monica College. Welcome to HealthCetera, Ferris.
Thank you so much for having me, Eve.
It's good to have you here. So tell us, tell us about Greenopia.
Sure. Yeah, it was a project that I did several years ago, actually around 2005. I met someone who wanted to put together a guide of green businesses. We really recognized that people want to do the right thing with their money. They just don't have the time to research it themselves. They don't know, they don't have the expertise to figure out, well, what questions do I even ask? And so we said, well, why don't we research all of Los Angeles, because that's where we live, and figure out, well, where are the places that are offering an environmentally friendly, you know, alternative to the products and services that we use every day as people, not this isn't like business to business stuff. And we found there were a lot of them. It was really, really cool and inspiring to see that there were about 1,200 businesses throughout Los Angeles that were really trying to do the right thing. And now we were just trying to connect the people who were willing to, you know, go out of their way to, you know, buy those products and services. And so that was the first time that we did it was in 2005. We then did it for New York City, so all five boroughs. We did San Francisco Bay Area. And, you know, it was so much fun because it was like a massive Easter egg hunt where you just imagine getting to go out and on foot with a, you know, team of like 20 people going into every business, acting like a secret shopper to find out, well, who's really doing the right thing? Who deserves to be in this guide? No one paid to be in the guide. So, you know, you can really trust the information. So it was something I was really proud of.
So what was the criteria for something to be considered a green business?
Right. Every there are 52 different categories of businesses, from pet grooming shops to architects to you know, coffee shops and bars. You know, they had to, at a minimum, to be in our guide, 25% of whatever they offered had to be an environmentally friendly alternative. And we had to define that even further for each one. So you can imagine, you know, if it was a grocery store, it was, you know, 25% of their SKUs had to be, you know, either organic, fair trade, GMO free, you know, so it varied from in each category, but we would, there were four levels. If it's 25%, 50%, 75% or higher, then they could be in the guide. But so it was, you know, it was pretty stringent, but we allowed for people who were just trying to get to do the right thing, to be listed so that people could find them. Because really that's one of the issues is that, you know, we shop where we shop, you know, and, you know, people aren't going to go that far out of their way. But if they know that they can turn left instead of right to just go find a better alternative, then, you know, then we'd rather that.
So how could someone right now get access to that information?
It's actually, we were printing a guide and selling them, which wasn't so sustainable, but we got a lot of those comments, but, you know, people needed to have it in their car. People didn't have smartphones then. This was back in 2005. I mean, come on. So it's all on, you know, app now or on their website. So, okay. Yeah, I'm actually not involved with them anymore, but yeah. They're doing good work, so.
Okay. that's good to hear. And what? How did you get involved in sustainability work in the first place?
Well, I went to college for marketing. I went to San Francisco afterwards, worked for an ad agency for several years. And I realized I just didn't, it wasn't what I wanted to do for the long run. And so I moved to Los Angeles, to Santa Monica, actually. Uh-huh. I took a class at Santa Monica College in 2001. Yeah, you didn't know this about me.
No.
And it was the Sustainable Living Workshop. It was a workshop that we still teach to students. We put about 600 students through an 8-week workshop that teaches them all about reducing their footprint in energy, water, waste, chemicals, transportation, food, shopping, so that they can kind of reduce their own personal footprint. And I, you know, it just struck my fancy. I thought, well, I've got some time to kill. Why don't I, you know, take this little workshop? It blew my mind. I didn't know what I didn't know, and it just sent me down a rabbit hole that was, you know, so interesting. And so I decided that that's what I wanted to do. I really wanted to spend my, you know, time and my talents promoting sustainability, because again, this was out back in 2001, and I felt like we really were preaching to the choir back then. We weren't expanding the base, and I felt like there, you know, I come from advertising, and you know, I had some skills that were being wasted selling people stuff they didn't need. So here I wanted to try to sell people, you know, something they did need. You know, information that they could use that made their lives better and the world better. So I ended up teaching that course. It was out in the community to apartment buildings. Then I did a few more things along the way. I, you know, produced this guide. I ended up working for the city of Burbank as a recycling specialist. And, you know, 14 years later, I ended up getting hired back at Santa Monica College to be the sustainability manager. So it's very, you know, beautiful, you know, poetic, like, circle.
It's come full circle.
Yeah, that's right.
You just mentioned about making people's lives better. And how would you describe that for someone who didn't know much about sustainability, who wasn't the choir that you're preaching to? Mm-hmm. How does this make their lives better?
Well, there's some ways that are easily tangible and some that are kind of, you know, harder to put your finger on. Mm-hmm. Things that are tangible are in the short term, if you're using your typical cleaning products around the home or beauty products on your body or shampoos, all of those things have an immediate effect on your health that you can notice the minute you start switching over to healthier products. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, there's tens of thousands of unregulated products that are on the shelves. And most people think that, well, we have the FDA and the EPA and all these agencies that are looking out for us. And yes, they are, but their powers are very limited, far more limited than we think. And so we put too much trust in them. And we need to buyer beware. You know, you need to really understand that what's on the shelves doesn't mean it's there because it has been proven not to harm people. Mm-hmm. There just haven't been enough lawsuits, and they haven't been able to, you know, create a chain where they can say, aha, this is the smoking gun. But we are, you know, so many chemicals bombarding our bodies all the time. They may be very low trace amounts, and that's how they're allowed to be on the shelves, and that's what the industry would argue, is that there's, you know, by itself, this one product, it has so little of whatever toxic chemical in there, it won't harm someone. And so the FDA, you know, will rubber stamp it. But then if you combine that one product with another, with another, with another, with the, you know, the fire retardants in our carpets, in our drapes, in our, you know, the foam in our mattresses, plus the VOCs coming up, you know, off-gassing from our paints. And you just are surrounded by a soup of toxicity. And once you start to realize that it really matters and that you can make better purchasing decisions, you can actually feel better right away. So that's one area that is very tangible. But then there's, you know, getting people out of their car more often, trying other modes of transportation. That's another one that's actually fairly tangible, but also intangible. So you're feeling better because maybe you're riding a bike for that short distance that you would have otherwise driven. And so you're feeling better. You're more in tune with the your environment, your neighborhood. You feel the cold on your cheek when you get to your destination. Your blood's pumping. It's a whole different experience than when you just get in your car and drive. And so people find something else to love about, you know, doing the green thing. But it's also doing this much bigger service is keeping the carbon out of the atmosphere, which is having these, you know, bigger effects of not just climate change, but respiratory disease and asthma for our kids. I've got two very young, beautiful girls, and I'm, you know, concerned about growing up in Los Angeles. We live between a freeway and an airport, you know?
Yeah.
And so, true. Yeah. So anyway, there's a whole range of ways that people can either feel it in their pocketbooks and you know, people think, oh, and environmental initiatives, oh, everything's going to cost me more. And in fact, you know, things can cost you less if you really understand, you know, that you don't have to actually buy a new set of cleaning products to put under your sink, but grab a, you know, a lemon wedge and some Bon Ami and, you know, some baking soda, and, you know, you really can be actually cheaper, you know, but there's intangibles and tangibles, but I feel like in every way, I just feel better about my choices, and voting with my dollar every day, you know, opting not to drive my car, because otherwise I'm giving the money to the fossil fuel industry that I don't feel like is in my best interest, or, you know, giving my money to a local coffee shop rather than, you know, a chain. You know, those are the I think big differences that have big multipliers that make our lives better if we're all doing it, you know.
And for listeners, I want you to know that Ferris walked in here with his bike helmet.
Up a very big hill, because this your office is in a right up on the top, the highest point in Santa Monica.
It's true. I think once you said, or I should ask, what have you seen and experienced between consumer awareness and consumer action?
Well, I think, I mean, there's a huge gap between with consumer awareness. And trust me, I used to be in advertising, and, you know, they have not spent the time they really need to on making people aware, and they're actually very good at making people unaware and thinking of other features to focus on, like cost or, you know, style and design, rather than, well, what's in it? Who made it? How far did it take to travel to get here? You know, what kind of, you know, conditions did people work in? And, you know, why the heck is it so cheap? You know,
yeah.
So often don't we look at a product and say, how is it possible that this thing can travel here from across the globe, and even just the material alone would be more expensive than what I'm looking at on the tag? So it's, you know, what people, I think, have good intentions. That's what I keep coming back to. Really, people want to spend their money on better products and services. They're willing to do it for the most part. And when asked, because there have been so many surveys that say, oh, you know, 80% of people would say they would buy a locally made or a, you know, healthier product if it were readily available. And that's, you know, that's really kind of where the rubber meets the road is, well, why aren't people spending their money on this? They just don't know where to go. Oftentimes it's not available. But you know what I tell students here at Santa Monica College? I do a lot of presentations, and I'm telling them there's an opportunity around every corner. Like, we have messed up this planet so, you know, so much that there's an opportunity to redesign everything that we do, everything. So I was pointing out there's a professor who was wearing a pair of Tom's glasses. Mm-hmm. And if you know Tom's, they make shoes and glasses. And for every one pair you buy, they give a pair to someone who needs them. And I happen to have a pair of sunglasses that were made from, and I have them right here. They are made by a company called Buro. And they are made from fishing nets that are found off the coast of Chile that end up entangling sea life. And so they're trying to get these fishing nets out of the ocean. But just pulling them out of the ocean, that's a big cost. But so if they're able to recoup the cost of that by turning them into the frames of sunglasses and skateboard decks, they're able to continue the program. So
those are pretty cool looking shades. Right? They are this matte black, really cool looking shades. Right, I really like them.
Very functional, polarized lenses. So here's what's neat is that there are two companies in the glasses frame world that are, you know, both doing sustainable work, you know. And so what's neat is that there's an opportunity in everything, and just because one company is already doing it doesn't mean you can't tweak your product and have two businesses competing for people's attention, because that, you know, you're doing good and doing well.
And you talked about marketing and being in that era, in that field. I guess my question is, how is that marketed? I've never heard of this company before. So mm-hmm. What is the marketing like around sustainability?
Well, thankfully, when I first got into it, and I was saying back in 2001, mm-hmm. it was abysmal. You know, it was still burlap and patchouli, and, you know, it was preaching to the choir, know, I'm a proud hippie. But, you know, we needed to get to the other 90% of the country. Mm-hmm. And I am happy to say that, you know, I think around 2005, there was a turning point where the media started focusing on this, because there was a kind of a perfect storm of events. Al Gore's film about climate change mm-hmm. had just come out. The Prius was on the market and selling better. The celebrities were talking about their pet green initiatives. Mm-hmm. And the media focused on it and kept their focus on it for more than a hot second. Because that's what the problem is. You know, they'll talk about an issue and then then it'll be on to what celebrity is doing what crazy thing instead of what celebrity is doing a good thing. Yeah. And so they actually focused on environmental issues and it stuck. So after, what was really interesting is in the 2008 recession, I thought, oh man, that's it. There's, you know, the first thing to be jettisoned from corporate, you know, agendas is going to be their sustainability initiatives. I didn't think that they were going to survive this this quote unquote recession. I'm doing the quote fingers here, and I was so surprised that they did. They really kept them, because sustainability had been a thing long enough, you know, 3-4 years, that the initiatives that they had taken on were actually paying for themselves. And so they realized, wow, first of all, people want this, so we're selling the products that we put on the market, and people are actually loving this stuff. But they're, you know, the energy conservation programs they put in place, they were working, they were paying for themselves. And they used to think that the cost of doing business just was a cost they couldn't avoid. They were going to create a whole lot of waste. They were going to use a lot of water in their production facilities. They were going to use a lot of electricity. If you want to make money, you got to just use these energy-intensive processes. And they never stopped to really question and look, well, what could we be doing and how much are we spending? That was just completely almost separate of their books. That was something that just wasn't going to be touched. Don't mess with that, because if we have less energy production, it must mean we're creating less widgets, and so we're going to be losing money, you know. So they kind of equated those two. But once people started to look and realize, wow, you could use technology to to reduce your water waste. You could reformulate, use less chemicals, which also, by the way, could mean that you would have less government oversight. You know, everyone hates regulation, right? Well, tell you what, you don't have to be regulated if you're not using a toxic input. So reformulate, and you can relieve yourself of that stress and that possible liability potential. You know, so they started to realize, wow, these things are working. So throughout that recession that started in 2008, these environmental programs and efforts really, you know, prove themselves, help maybe businesses make it through as well. And now we're, you know, on the other side, and I see that they're going strong, you know, at a federal level. Yes. I think that there's, you know, having the EPA, having, you know, the Department of Energy, you know, does a lot to help push sustainability forward. There's so many different agencies that have up till now had the marching orders to, you know, figure out how to move forward using less energy and to help, you know, companies that are, you know, coming up with new technologies to help test them and get them to market as quickly as possible and make them, you know, something that can help everyone else. But now with the new administration, yes, it's not that we're unsure. We're pretty darn sure what is going to happen to those programs. But
and what is going to happen to those programs?
Well, there's a real potential for that they're going to be cut. The monies are going to be focused elsewhere. You know, they're going to be put on the back burner, and that has real consequences. Right now, I'm looking at a very narrow window that we have. I mean, this window is shutting very quickly, and it's a window of, you know, an opportunity to turn the ship around and start, you know, getting us off fossil fuels and so that we can avoid the worst of climate change. I mean, really, the window depends on who you talk to.
Yes.
There are many windows that have already shut. We miss those opportunities, yes, to avoid the, you know, any climate change impacts. So we're going to have that. But the worst of it, we could still avoid. But if we are waiting another 4 years, it makes a big, big difference. And we can't afford to.
And when we listen to the current administration and people questioning whether something like global warming actually exists.
Mm-hmm.
That is a lot of re-education, it seems.
It is. It really is. It's, you know, follow the money is what I say. You know, it's a very simple principle. If you've heard stories, you know, it's going to take a lot to try to re-educate people on every point. So what I say is, well, where did you hear that? And who's really, if you think about who's at stake, you know, because I've heard the argument that, well, the environmentalists, the scientists, the nonprofits, they have so much to gain by pushing this agenda of, you know, phony climate change story. But really, like, if you follow the money, who stands to gain from the climate change, you know, or solar, you know, production? Yeah, there are a few companies, solar companies, sure, but really, who is profiting the most right now? It's the fossil fuel. It's just the oil, gas, coal industry that is making money hand over fist and enjoying heavy subsidies. And they want to keep the status quo. And so there's a lot of reasons they would want to seed doubt in people's minds. And so I always say, like, walk into one of these nonprofits sometime in your local community and talk to a few people. See if they really stand to make a huge profit on what they do. Or do they seem to be more in it because they really just want a better planet for themselves and their kids. Then go and try to walk into the lobby of a you know, oil and gas conglomerate and, you know, try to talk to someone there about, you know, their issues. And I think, you know, it might become very apparent who's...
Yeah. And so what, in terms of what can our listeners do, you know, with these disputes right. that are going on about global warming? And I think people could possibly be torn, you know, what's right, what's not right. What do you think?
Well, okay. I feel like there is, during the Bush administration, there was the same kind of, you know, well, the administration really treated environmental issues in the same way, and they the Bush administration did, you know, they I know you're gonna be able to edit this. So let me think about this. The Bush administration in what, 2008? What was it? Is that right? 2008? Yeah. Okay, so the Bush administration had the same goals to push for more fossil fuel use, so oil and gas, and people were really concerned about the same issues back then. And after a while, they realized, it took them a little longer, I think, to realize that, okay, we weren't going to get any love here from this administration on renewables. So, you know what happened? People started stepping up. At the local state, countywide levels, the mayors, the governors, they said, we have to do this. And it wasn't just the mayors and governors. I want to make clear that they knew their constituents, and right. their constituents were standing up saying that this is, you know, a priority. We can't just let our, you know, be dictated to from the top. And so I actually wanted to give George W. Bush some kind of medal for his environmental achievements, because without his outright hostility towards environmental issues, we wouldn't have had this groundswell of people who said, that's enough. We see that we don't have any help from above. Why wait for them? Let's do it ourselves. We can put in... you know, levels that we're going to just achieve at the local and state level. And we've seen it in California. We've achieved everything that we've set out to do, and most places have achieved it early. And so we're showing the rest of the country it's possible, and it's possible to do well and do good. And we're, but that's just not being recognized at the federal level. So we just have to continue to do that and really, you know, speak up to your local representatives. We kind of know that it's going to fall on deaf ears at the top level. So, you know, get together, find out who your environmental organization is locally. There is so much power that we have at the local and state level, municipal level. That we need to recognize that and don't feel helpless because they're not going to pay attention at the top. The one other thing that I would say
yeah.
is vote with your dollars. Every day you have a choice to support the structure that's currently in place or get out of your car, drive less, because every time we fill up that tank, we know that where that money is going. And that's the last thing they think we are going to change about ourselves. You know, they know that we are heavily addicted to our cars and thus to oil and gas. And if we can, you know, if you can, try to get out of that car as often as possible, because that really makes a difference. That's going to make a dent in their pocketbooks, and that's, you know, a way of circumnavigating the system, you know. Yeah. Sure, you can send a letter to your state senator or to, you know, the president, but really, if we don't feel like those letters are going to be taken seriously, well, stop giving money to them.
And what you're saying in terms of using the car is especially true here in California.
Yes.
You know, I mean, you've done a lot of work here at Santa Monica College in terms of getting people to use alternative means of transportation.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a very car-heavy, heavily used state. Yeah.
But it is changing. Eve, this is the first year that I have seen the potential for us to actually end up looking more like Chicago, New York, San Francisco. Because there's been an explosion of new transportation options. We've got new rail lines that have opened. We've got bike share that's popping up all over. You've got just Uber and Lyft to complete that last mile. You know, I don't want you to use it for everything, and some students do. It's incredible. But, you know, you've got the pool versions of these things. So you can actually get rid of your car. And I'm hearing it from friends more and more that they got rid of their car and they're doing great without it. And it's liberating. You think that people are afraid to get rid of the car because their lifestyle is going to be restricted. But no, in fact, they've got more choices and you don't have to worry where your car is parked and payments on it and getting tickets and did your meter expire and all of that. You just get dropped off right out in front and walk on in. So,
You've also talked about food waste.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think, people have heard the news reports recently that we've realized that about 40% of food is wasted in this country. So much of it doesn't even make it, to our homes. And what does is still, what doesn't help is having these freshness dates on everything. Everyone is so paranoid of letting anything sit in your fridge longer than that freshness date. But that's,
Are you saying that we can ignore those freshness?
Pretty
things?
Much.
Oh, wow.
Use your nose, It really, those things are on there. I mean, when you see a can of soda and it's got a freshness date on it that's only, 6 months long or something, that's pretty ridiculous. But the other end of it is, what are you doing with all that food waste? And, what happens to it is it's sent off to a landfill, turns into methane gas, which is a global warming gas. It's 70 times worse than carbon. And carbon is the boogeyman that we all talk about in terms of climate change. But methane is what's produced at all of our landfills because rotting food and organics. So composting is the most elegant solution to so many stacked problems. I mean, you've got a 30,000-pound trash truck that picks up trash, drives it, at least an hour out of town in a vehicle that gets 3.5 miles per gallon, potential accidents, wear and tear on freeways, all the costs. Plus, you're paying someone to send it out, right? And then dump it and fill up a big hole somewhere. But then the opposite end of that is if you composted it, you're avoiding all of those negatives. And when you compost, you are producing nutrient-rich soil that can be used in your garden, and you avoid having to use pesticides because your plants are healthier. You don't have to buy fertilizer, which, by the way, was probably made 300 miles away and trucked to market. And, so you avoid those transportation miles, and you're making yourself something that you don't have to buy, and you're avoiding all the other negatives. So composting, you create a stack of positives out of something and avoid a higher stack of negatives. So I love composting.
Do you think people who live in cities can also compost?
Well, the Santa Monica College is a small city. We've got 27,000 students, plus 2,000 employees. We have our own police department. We're a small city.
Yeah.
We compost using 400,000 worms. We compost about 250 pounds of food waste from the cafeteria every week, turn it into nutrient-rich soil that is used by our groundskeepers on all of our plants. So it's doable on a larger scale, you know, it's like a big cafeteria scale.
Yeah.
And in, as a city dweller, I've lived in LA or San Francisco pretty much all my life. And I've had, for the past 15 years, I've had a little worm composting bin, a small thing you just put out on your porch, and you pretty much takes care of all the coffee grounds and potato peelings and stale bread and chips, eggshells, pretty much everything that you go through in a given week. And so you know what's the best part about composting? You don't have to change your garbage so often. Like literally we put out our garbage maybe once every 2 weeks or so because our garbage doesn't fill up. It doesn't stink because you don't have food decomposing in your garbage. You come home from work and it's been 90 degrees out. You come home and it's only been 2 days since you last changed the garbage. But, you lift that lid and you're almost balled over because something in there has gone bad. But when you're composting, that doesn't happen because all that is buried underneath some when you do it right and bury it and it won't smell, you won't get fruit flies, and it's a beautiful, elegant system. Yeah, wow. I love it.
Okay, you have really given me something to think about.
Yeah, we'll have to get you over to see the worms.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. We do it at my office and I do it at home. It's great. Yeah. Okay. So it's very much something you can do in the city. You don't need a backyard. You don't need very much space. You need about 2.5 feet by 4 feet or so to do something, which I know can be tough in New York.
Yeah, but just the idea that you could do it in an apartment.
Yes, very much so. Okay. Yeah, and a lot of people do.
Okay, I like that idea. Okay. Yeah. Is there anything else that you'd like to share with our listeners?
You know,
about your work and
No, I just am. I'm constantly inspired by the people who are coming up with new solutions, and I worry for our future and for my kids' future, but I also see how many people are smart and dedicated and are really putting their values up front and saying, you know what, this matters, this is important to me, and they're doing the right thing, and they're not just going out and figuring out new technological solutions, but they're doing the little things every day that matter. And so we know that we're on the right side of history, and I think we'll figure this out somehow. But yeah, I get inspired by the people I get to talk to every day, like you. Thank you, Eve.
Well, I am impressed by all of the initiatives that you have started at the college, just like I didn't even know about the cafeteria and the waste food, and bicycle racks and skateboard racks and all of those different things. And I think that's a real, that's very impressive, and that's a great example for how to continue this.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what we keep learning is that when you provide the opportunity for someone to do good, you know, like when you have a big event and you put out a composting bin next to the trash and recycling, people love it because they've never been offered the opportunity not to waste, you know, and so they love it and they always have great comments. So when you provide the bike racks, when you provide these things, suddenly people come out of the woodwork saying, thank you. I, you know, no one ever even asked to do this because I think for so long people just expected, people were not interested in environmental issues. And I think that we just weren't asking the right questions. You know, we weren't providing it. I liken it to the Prius launch. Mm-hmm. They pretty much came up with the ugliest car they could manage, and it sold like hotcakes. It sold so well. I have one of those first-generation Priuses, and I don't drive it. I fill my tank once every five and a half months.
Oh, wow.
So it's great. It's a wonderful feeling. But it's so funny because despite how ugly that first car was, people bought it in droves because it was the first time they had a choice. And so businesses are finally figuring that out, that people really will go out of their way and they do want the right thing on the shelf. So they're struggling to to provide all of those, to shift over. So that's what I tell all of our students is that, you know, you have an opportunity and businesses are looking for you. They're looking for you to be the person who helps shepherd them onto the right path.
Well, thank you. Thank you for being on HealthCetera. HealthCetera is streaming online at www.wbai.org, or you can listen to HealthCetera anytime at www.healthmediapolicy.com. Thank you for listening today.